there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 255. If you have something to say to us, pen some words, type it out, and send it on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, and of course, go to the Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. What a jam-packed show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Kurt Loder is a journalist, an author, a columnist, a film critic, a TV personality. He was a staff writer and senior editor at Rolling Stone for close to a decade during a tenure that has been called, and I quote Kurt, legendary. He was the writer and host of MTV's The Week in Rock for more than a decade and a movie reviewer for MTV.com. He is the author of Bat Chain Puller, Rock and Roll in the Age of Celebrity, and co-author of Tina Turner's autobiography, I, Tina, which was, of course, a New York Times bestseller. If there's a show out there in the world with some pop culture cachet, Kurt Loder has had a cameo on it. His latest book is a collection of movie reviews called The Good, The Bad, and The God-Awful. He currently writes movie reviews for Reason.com, and holy cow, is he a hero of mine. Kurt Loder, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
How are you doing, Ken?
I'm doing pretty well. Are you ready, sir? So much ground to cover.
I am. I'm just exhausted by all those credits.
And I had to leave some out, Kurt.
I probably forgot them anyway.
Well, let's see. We'll test your memory. We'll do a little Kurt Loder, This Is Your Life. You grew up as a fellow New Jersey native. Fond memories of the Garden State?
I haven't been back there in a while, but yeah, you know, this is South Jersey, so it was, you know, beaches and, you know, summer frolicking and stuff. So, yeah, I had a good childhood.
Pretty nice stuff.
Where are you from?
Oh, we're northern New Jersey. It's like a whole different state.
It sure is.
It's like above the Mason-Dixon. It's a whole different thing, Kurt. It's a whole different thing. Now, the way I read it, you went into the Army to get journalism education. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it was back in the Vietnam years because I'm very, very old. But I was going to get drafted because they had a military draft then. And if you would give them an extra year and sign up for 3 years, they would let you pick what you wanted to do. I picked journalism, and they had a school for journalism, and I went there for 2 months and learned everything I know about journalism, for better or worse.
I must say, you have said this. You've been quoted as saying, quote, you can learn journalism in 4 weeks. It's not an overcomplicated thing. It's very, very simple, and I can't imagine stretching it out to 4 years, but I'm told that's done. Do you realize, Kurt Loder, that you're like the antichrist of admissions departments at journalism schools?
Well, I don't want to be ignorant about it. I'm sure, you know, you can get something out of going to, you know, doing 4 years of, you know, communications or whatever. But I think journalism is a trade. It's not a profession, and the elements of the trade are fairly easy to learn. You know, if you can write, you can be a journalist. Even if you can't, you know, you can be a great reporter.
How would you go about describing your voice as a journalist?
I don't know. You would have to tell me, probably. I think when you write, you always try to be conversational as much as possible, and do lots of research so you have something to say and you're not just blathering. I don't know what my voice would be. Pleasing, I hope.
We agree.
Do you have any thoughts on it yourself? I don't know.
So many thoughts about your voice, which we're going to get to in a few minutes. You spent some time with Circus Magazine, and I fear, Kurt, that many of our listeners don't know a ton about Circus Magazine.
I know. It's a shame, isn't it? It's out of business now, but it was for a long time. It was a pop-heavy metal magazine, and you know, there were a lot of, you know, teen hero guitar boys on the cover with no shirts and stuff like that. But it also covered kind of hard metal. It was fun, you know. It was in the late 70s, and I was there with a friend of mine, David Frick, who now works for Rolling Stone. And we had a good time. It was a good time in New York.
Well, you've spoken about that in other interviews, just about frequenting CBGBs, going to the Bottom Line. How would you go about describing that scene, and can we find that anywhere now?
No. It's all over.
Yeah.
You know, Times Square is a Disney slum. Changed a lot. I mean, New York was in a very bad state in the late 70s. It was broke, essentially. And it was, you know, it's kind of dangerous walking around Times Square. So it was very exciting because who knows what would happen to you. But the club scene was great. I mean, Max's Kansas City and CB's and all these places, you know, you could smoke inside. There was that. And you could, you know, smoke marijuana on the street. And what are people going to do? So I don't think that's coming back. It was great, but, you know, today is great, too, I'm sure. If you're, like, you know, 18 years old, you're having a good time as well.
Which neither of us are. I hate to break it to both of us, Kurt.
So true. true.
Well, you moved over to Rolling Stone, and you've said so many times, and I love this, just that Rolling Stone has, which it continues to, a very high standard of journalism. What did that translate into for someone working with Rolling Stone?
There weren't many publications that really take journalism seriously in the sense that they have a whole copy editing department. The New Yorker is like this too, and they really take copy editing seriously and fact checking seriously. I mean, the people who write movie reviews for the New Yorker, the fact checkers will go see the movie they're reviewing to make sure he knows what he's talking about. And to care about that, I mean, editing is dying out.
Even
when you're publishing books, you don't even get edited, so it's not a good thing.
No. 1987 rolls around, and suddenly, and I'm sure there was more of a process to it, but you're on MTV, which I don't know if you knew at the time, Kurt Loder, that's not a print publication.
I was misinformed.
What was the process?
I was working at Rolling Stone. They called me up and said, would you like to be on TV? I had never thought of such a thing. And I don't really have any TV skills to speak of, but it was fun because the channel had just started several years earlier. So it was a situation where they're making it up as they go along. So it was very open and you could do a lot of stuff. So it was exciting in that regard. And at that period, there was just a lot of money around.
Yeah.
I didn't have all of it, but there's a lot of money. And if you wanted to, you could say, well, let's go shoot a show in Tokyo. And off you go to Tokyo. I mean, I don't think that happens anymore either, but I could be wrong.
Well, what were your goals with MTV News?
To try and make it like news. I mean, the guy who was the founding producer had come from CNN. So the idea was, much like Rolling Stone when it started out, that although you're covering sort of pop music and pop culture, you can do it in a news way, and you can really research it, you can get your facts right, and it was just a new way of doing things, I think, at the time. So it was fun to do that, and it was, you know, you try and break stories. It's like any news thing.
Yeah.
I don't think they really do that so much anymore, but there's not as much money around.
Right. Right. If you were to do, by the way, Kurt Loder word association and you go online, the word deadpan comes up a lot.
Really? I wonder why. Do I sound like a deadpan person? I suppose I am. You know, I don't really have any TV chops like that. I can't be effervescent. I fail to be effervescent. And I think that's kind of important in TV, so I haven't pursued TV any further.
You have the Kurt Loder wit, which we'll get to as well. Let's talk about some peaks and valleys. Let's start with some highs. Tell me about someone that you interviewed who just surprised you, who walked away from that and thought, all right, that was a great piece.
It's always great to talk to Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones because he's actually very, very intelligent, and he's the best sort of interview subject because he will say anything.
Yeah,
nothing is out of bounds. You know, you want to talk about anything, we'll talk about it. So that's always good. And I once did the Everly Brothers, and that was kind of a heartbreaking thing. And Lou Reed was always an interesting interview. So to me, I think you can talk to anybody and be surprised by them. You could talk to the guy on the corner, and everybody has a story to tell. So that in itself is kind of interesting.
Total side note, folks, listeners, if you have not read Kurt Loder's obit of Lou Reed, it's just an inspired read.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very sad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, because these stories always seem to inspire our listeners, Kurt, what about one of those times where, just hard as you tried, the content just didn't come out?
Well, that happens all the time, actually. I mean, if you're writing stuff, there's stuff you're going to write and you'll say, well, that's pretty good. And there's stuff you're going to write and you just think it's horrible.
Yeah.
The deadline, you have to turn it in, and you're not happy about it, and you never read it again. So that's an ongoing thing. I think you're always learning about writing, no matter how old you get. There's always something new to learn, which is, gives life meaning, I think.
Totally. Can I tell you my favorite Kurt Loder interview?
Please do.
Now, I would just like to preface this with, I might be doing some sort of revisionist history, and it didn't really happen like this, but this is the way I remember it. I used to be a huge Tori Amos fan, and then I suddenly realized I had no idea what she was talking about. There was some transition. And so you interviewed Tori Amos, and it was one of her particular string of words that just didn't make a ton of sense in that order. Cut back to the studio where there was a beat, there was a pause with the camera on Kurt Loder, and I can't remember exactly what you said. Either it was okay or okay. Is this ringing a bell at all?
I talked to her once face to face, and she's a very interesting woman. I don't know. She's in sort of another dimension. It's like a Bjork thing. But she's very, very talented. I don't remember that far back. It's hopeless.
I remember thinking, oh, Kurt Loder doesn't know what she's talking about either. It was validating.
Oh, well, good.
Yes. No, I appreciate it.
I'm here to help.
Well, I have put together all this various LGBT-related ephemera that I've strung together from your career, and these are in no particular order. You ready for some gay connections for this show Is So Gay?
Hit it. We should start with Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which is coming to Broadway.
How do you feel about that?
That's such a great idea. Neil Patrick Harris is in the John Cameron Mitchell role. I saw the original show back in, like, 1998 or something. It's brilliant. And I can't wait to see this. It goes into previews next week.
And sold out all over the place already.
Yeah, it's going to be fabulous.
Okay, so I got to get back to New York and see that. Well, definitely wanted to hit on the diva, Miss Tina Turner. In my head, Kurt, you two always have some sort of like words with friends game going on, even right now. Is that in any way true?
Well, we're not in contact online, but
I just feel like you always have this connection with Tina Turner.
Well, I grew up with her music, and I was very inspired by the early stuff she did with her husband, Ike, on Sue Records back in, like, 1960 or something. And she hated all that stuff. It was really hardcore R&B music. And she just associated with, you know, this abusive relationship with him, and it was in the wrong key, and she was shouting a lot. But I love that stuff, and she disagreed. But she's an amazing person. She's had an incredible life. She's gone through a lot.
Yeah.
And just where she came from, like Brownsville, Tennessee, Nutbush, Tennessee, and just became, you know, conquered the world. So she lives in Switzerland now, and she's married to a guy who used to be with EMI Records, and she's apparently very happy. I haven't seen her in several years.
Well, the year was 1995. You're sitting down with LGBT icon Madonna. You're just chatting it up before the VMAs. And then Courtney Love starts throwing things at the two of you.
It lives on forever on YouTube.
Well, it does. And one of the reasons it lives on, Kurt, is because, and I quote, and I typed it out verbatim, this is what you said. You said, "Hi, Courtney, everybody's favorite," and then you didn't get a chance to finish that sentence. So I didn't know, maybe, Kurt, if you wanted to take the opportunity now to finish that sentence?
Well, Courtney is, you know, it's sort of, you know, just insane. And at the time, it was everybody's favorite, I don't know, traffic accident.
There you go.
But she's an interesting person, and she was totally out of control, and frankly may still be for all I know. So it was interesting to see her. We were talking to Madonna. She started throwing things up on this little stage we had. And the guy in my ear, I think Madonna's manager was there saying, "Don't bring Courtney up on stage, whatever you do." But a guy in my ear back in the control room saying, "Get her up there, Amelia. Great television." So up she came, and you know, the rest is YouTube.
Which consists, by the way, of a minute or two of you looking back and forth, and I rather admired how you just stepped back from that, because there really wasn't anything for you to do, Kurt.
No, I didn't belong there. I was chopped liver.
I love it. Well, in 2000, Eminem was trotted out to everyone, and he was trotted out to you to declare that he wasn't homophobic in an interview with you where he kind of sounded homophobic.
He's a complicated guy, obviously. But he worked with Elton John, too. He's just one of those people who has a lot going on inside of him. I mean, we tried to pin him down on that in one interview we did, but he, you know, his manager just called an end to the interview and said, "No more of that." So he's a controversial figure, obviously, but I think he's really for real. He still lives in Detroit. He still makes great records. And, you know, it's like the Woody Allen situation or something. You know, somebody whose work you love may be a difficult person, but it's like Mel Gibson also. But their work is still great work. So,
right.
you know, that's how I look at it.
Right. And then I suppose I would be remiss, although I even told my sister when I mentioned that you would be on and she fangirled out. She said, can you not talk about Sebastian Bach? But we would be slightly remiss on This Show Is So Gay if we did not at least reference 1989. And I would just like to say, this was the sentence that lives on in infamy that you wrote. You said, quote, in the land of homophobia, if Axl Rose owns the restaurant and Public Enemy are the diners, we have a new busboy. Regardless of Sebastian Bach, you totally
remember.
Well, you're killing me, because my question was, did you not write that and just look up and grin?
Probably. I don't know. He was that was difficult. You know, he had done something at a theater way out of New York, but we got some footage of it. And he was wearing this T-shirt that said, you know, AIDS kills fags dead or something. It was a riff on the Raid sort of motto.
Right.
And we just looked at it and we said, you know, this is really beyond the pale here. You've got to call this guy on this. And, you know, his band at the time was a big band. And normally in the music business, you don't want to upset anybody because you might want to have them on your show or something. We just said, you know, no. You have to say something about this. So we did. We ran the footage and just said, this is wrong, and, you know, is this guy crazy or what? He's a nice guy, too, but, you know, you got to draw a line somewhere.
There's a lot of complicated people out there, I'm guessing, Kurt.
We're all complicated.
Well, let's turn to the movies. Let's turn to the movies. I've been reading through The Good, the Bad, and the God-Awful, and it starts with this sentence. I wish I could say I'm a film critic, but I'm not really. I'm a movie reviewer. For our listeners, how would you characterize the difference?
I think film critics are people that, you know, have spent their lives in movie theaters and really know everything. Pauline Kael's the obvious example, but Anthony Lane of The New Yorker. There are people who are really film critics. They can talk in an interesting way about movies because they know a lot. I think the majority of the people you see on like RottenTomatoes.com or something, not to put them down, but they're reviewing movies. They go see it and they say, this is the movie and I liked it or I hated it, and that's pretty much it. You don't get any elaboration on it. So I'm a movie reviewer for sure. You know, I think I know a lot about certain kinds of movies, but I don't have the entire history of the art in my head.
I gotta say, in this book, there really are some god-awful movies that you review.
There are. There are very bad movies. I'm anxiously awaiting now The Human Centipede 3.
It'll
surely be out before the end of the year. And I just wrote up Nymphomaniac, the Lars von Trier movie, which is really an exciting experience. Shia LaBeouf is in it. You'll never see him again. But it's a porn movie done by an artist. It's a very interesting film. It's very funny in points, too. I don't know if it's coming to a theater near you, but it's available on video on demand.
Do you ever walk out?
I rarely walk out. I think I've walked out of two movies in my life. You know, your job is to be there and suffer through it, so you suffer through it. I think that's important.
Do you get combat pay for certain movies?
You should, I suppose. There are some. I thought, you know, Spring Breakers was just an amazingly pretentious film. A lot of people loved it. So, God, it's the high form of the art here. But I thought that was terrible. But, you know, you sit through it and write what you think about it, and, you know, sometimes you say unpopular things, but so what?
Right. Well, you wrote this, one of, I have to say, my least favorite movies of all time. I now pronounce you Chuck and Larry. And this is a quote from Kurt Loder, everybody. This is what you wrote, quote, this tolerance lecture trying to pass as a funny movie brings us the news that, brace yourself, gay men are actually okay. In fact, they're just like other people, except for the gay thing, which normal guys make that other guys can easily get past if they'll just grow some sensitivity.
Yeah, it was a movie that was leading up to the obvious thing was to have these two guys kiss at the end, two, you know, straight guys, but they just blew it. They didn't do it. They weren't going to go that far, and it just made the whole movie a fraud. I really dislike that film. Did you see it?
See, Kurt, I don't get paid for these reviews, so I walked out.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I didn't have to stay like you did.
Yeah, it was really offensive, that movie. I just, God.
Well, you wrote an amazing review of Milk, and in that review you said this, quote, "And in Sean Penn, the director has a near-perfect star, a straight actor capable of playing a gay man without holding back in depicting Milk's mannerisms, but without treading anywhere near gay caricature either."
I think that's very difficult to do, because you can obviously, you know, make a caricature out of that person. But I think Sean Penn was one of his best performances. He really captured the guy, and you felt him as a complete human being, and it was very good, I thought.
Quite a bit of pushback from the LGBT community after Dallas Buyers Club for exactly that reason of, all right, should we be having non-LGBT folks playing LGBT roles when there are qualified actors out there? What is your take?
I think that's entirely wrong. It's like, you know, should we have blue-eyed actors play, you know, blue-eyed characters? I don't buy that at all. I think you've got to, you know, the actors in that movie are great. They're terrific. And it doesn't matter if you're gonna base hiring actors on their sexual orientation or on their political stance or whatever. You're not dealing with getting good actors. You're dealing with something else, and you're betraying in whatever project you're working on. So I feel.
My niece called me earlier today, said that I must go see Divergence, but I said, let me hold on and check with Kurt Loder.
I like Divergent. It was, it's sort of like a little more than the Hunger Games movies. And Shailene Woodley, who's in it, this is her breakthrough. She's a major star. She's really great. It has a target audience. It's like teen girls, but I think it resonates beyond that. And it's good. It's an enjoyable movie. I thought it was, I didn't walk out of it.
Okay. You don't walk out of anything. That wasn't an endorsement.
That's true.
What else is coming up that you're excited for?
Well, I just saw something they actually called Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson, which is a very, very, very strange movie. It's like a sci-fi movie, and it's by Jonathan Glazer, his director who did Sexy Beast like years and years
ago. Oh, yeah, of course.
He also did Birth, the strangest Nicole Kidman movie ever made. And this is a really strange film. She's, you know, Scarlett Johansson is obviously somebody who comes down to earth, and it's sort of vague, and it's dark, and it's mysterious, and Scarlett spends a lot of time naked, which I suppose is a selling point, probably. And, well, it is a selling point. I think let's be honest about that. And it's an unusual film, and it's coming out in a week or two or something. You know, depending on your mood, you might want to see it.
Okay. All right. And apparently that Nymphomaniac movie.
Yeah, it's an interesting film.
Okay.
It's actually a 4-hour movie, but it's been divided in half, so there's volume one and volume two. I suspect one should see the entire thing, but I saw volume one. I thought it was very interesting.
The book, The Good, the Bad, and the God-Awful, you can get it on iTunes. I downloaded it there, but you can go to Amazon or anywhere, find books are sold. What else you got coming up? You're continuing to write at Reason.com?
I still write there. I occasionally do a little television here and there, not much, and as little as possible, because I'm essentially inert. I have to run out and do it, and I try and find new bands to listen to all the time. But apart from that, I don't have any real news to report. I feel bad about that.
No. You're Kurt Loder. That's the whole thing in itself. Because if folks don't know, one of my favorite pop culture references for you would be from Workaholics, where the character asked himself, WWKLD, what would Kurt Loder do?
Oh, yeah. I heard about that. That was cute. That was very sweet of them. I did Portlandia last year, and that was a great thing to do, too. So it's nice to be involved with things like that are such a high quality.
And you know you've made it when you're a character on South Park.
Yes. That was actually the high point of my life. Great.
By the way, in my happy place, I thought you were going to bust out of nowhere and say, oh, no, that Tori Amos interview, that was the highlight of my career. That's how I remember it, Kurt.
Well, do you have highlights in your career? Do you have a favorite movie of all time, a favorite record of all time? I don't think those things exist.
Yeah.
You might have many, many highlights. There are many, many, you know, bands that you like. You can't just pick one. I think that's kind of silly.
Yeah.
Like the Oscars, I'm sort of opposed to pitting artists against each other as if, you know, you can really compare that sort of thing. I don't think you can.
Well, as if it has anything to do with their performances anyway, Kurt. There's that. There's that. Well, again, the name of the book is The Good, the Bad, and the God-Awful. I said it at the start, Kurt. You bring integrity to everything that you do, and it was really a formative experience for me as a budding journalist to watch the station that I'd always been watching and see you on there and bring a gravitas and, again, this integrity and truthfulness in the midst of so much else going on. And just, I sit in admiration of your work.
Let me sit down here. This is incredible. Thank you very much. It's very sweet of you.
All right, Kurt. Well, again, everyone, go check out the book, Kurt Loder. What a treat. All right, folks, and we are back with our next incredible guest. Suzanne Wong is an actor, television host, stand-up comedian, author, keynote speaker, radio host, writer, teacher, coach, universal life minister, and political activist. You know her from her memorable stint as Polly on Las Vegas and her guest-starring turns on Cold Case, Two and a Half Men, Boston Legal, Knit Tuck, The Practice, so many more. HGTV fans all around the world know her as the longtime host of House Hunters and House Hunters International. Dorks like me get all excited when she stood alongside Dick Clark co-hosting TV Censored Bloopers. As a stand-up comic, she's performed all over the world and was bestowed with the Andy Kaufman Award at the first annual New York Comedy Festival, as well as the Best Up-and-Coming Comedian Award at the Las Vegas Comedy Festival. She's told Oprah what to read. She stood next to Pamela Anderson and camped it up on VIP. And now she's one of the stars of From Here On Out, the hit new original comedy on Here TV. Suzanne, welcome to the show, So Gay.
Oh my God, Ken, that intro was so great. I want to date me. My parents would love that intro. Thank you so much.
And I left so much out, Suzanne. So much.
Well, you know, I'm one of those Asian overachievers.
And we will talk about that. We're going to do quite a bit of Suzanne, This Is Your Life, because you've been all over the place.
Yes, I have. I'm 51. I've led a wonderful, rich, full life already. I also love that you are a self-identified dork for liking bloopers. So
oh my
of all
gosh.
The things that I've done, you're a dork for liking bloopers? Why is that?
I have to tell you, I grew up on Dick Clark and Ed McMahon's TV Bloopers and Practical Jokes.
Me too. I always loved them, and I always love at a movie when during the closing credits they show bloopers from shooting the movie.
So much better often than the movie.
I know. That's my favorite when people do that.
And indeed, Ed McMahon, see, I have not had this experience where Ed McMahon said, hey, you're very funny, but he said that to you.
That was crazy. So I did this show called, I can't remember if that was from Breakfast Time or Fox After Breakfast, but they were both morning shows, national morning shows. One was on FX and one was on Fox, and they were both hosted by my friend Tom Bergeron, who I had been friends with for, I think, 10 years before we worked together on those shows. And sometimes they would have a celebrity guest be in the announcer booth with the woman who would be the announcer for the show. And one day it was Ed McMahon in the booth with Nancy Giles, and I was co-hosting in the studio. Normally they would have me out on the road as one of the road warriors doing different cool live human interest segments for the show, but when the female co-host would be sick or on vacation, they'd pull me off the road and have me host in the studio. And Ed McMahon decides to interrupt what Tom Bergeron is saying and tell me how funny I am, and that was just such a dear moment. He and Dick Clark could not have been nicer people.
Now, were I in your shoes, I would have elbowed Tom Bergeron and gotten him off screen so that you could just do it by yourself.
Just push him out of the way, right?
He said I was funny, Tom, get off.
Well, you know, Tom has a very long torso and a low center of gravity. It might have been hard to knock him over.
That's true. That's true. And we enjoy him from, obviously, Dancing with the Stars, and I loved Hollywood Squares. I'm such a game show fan.
Me too. I was such a freak for Pyramid when I was a kid.
Oh,
also
yeah.
Dick Clark. And, yeah, I would have loved to have been on that show with Dick Clark hosting.
Now, I don't want to skip ahead because we're going to talk about From Here On Out later, but as we learned a few weeks ago when we had Terry Ray on the show, he was quite the game show contestant.
I know. How great is that?
Have you ever watched his YouTube clips of
I
when
haven't,
he...
I haven't, but I saw it. I haven't clicked on it yet. Tell me, which is he on Pyramid?
He is on Scrabble, and the stuff that he says to Chuck Woolery defies description. If you're looking for something to do for the rest of your day, Suzanne, you now have it.
Oh, perfect. Is there something up there with the, that would have to be the butt bob? Is it like that from Newlywed Game? You know about that.
Oh, right? I know about, I love that. Oh, man. I could talk game shows all day. I love it. I love it. But we have so much else. We have so much else. All right. We got to take you back a little bit. Just one of your first starring turns that, of course, everybody I'm sure knows about, when you were the valedictorian of your graduating class in your high school and you gave the invocation at your graduation ceremony.
I really do feel like I'm on This Is Your Life right now. Yes, I haven't thought about that in a long time. My paternal grandfather, Reverend Andrew Chaekyung, was his Korean name, Hwang, was a famous Korean minister who traveled the world preaching. He was so famous and controversial for using humor in his sermons. And he also was one of the hosts of on the Voice of America, which is the official radio broadcasting network for the U.S. government. It's in 44 different languages. And so I am more famous in the United States, in the Korean community, for being his granddaughter than I am for anything that I've ever done.
Wow.
On television. And so it's interesting to me how, and now I'm a universal life minister. I've studied New Thought, Science of Mind, Metaphysics, and I do guest sermons that are sort of funny and irreverent all over the country and in Canada. And so, but it started when I became valedictorian of my high school class at the age of 16 because I skipped a couple of grades. I'm one of those,
of course,
wicked, smart Asian people. they asked me to give the invocation. Here's what was crazy about that experience. So I'm 16, and I'm giving the invocation, which is the, I guess, opening prayer for the graduation ceremony. We are on our football field outside. I think, you know, it's quite a large high school student body. And they gave me, I was standing at a podium with a microphone, but the microphone echoed throughout the football stadium. And if you've never had that experience, here's what happens. You speak a word, but you don't hear it back for about a second and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's very strange. It's like, you know, you're not supposed to wait till you hear the word you said to say the next word. Otherwise, it'll sound crazy.
Right.
But it's also crazy to keep talking while you're hearing your voice back to you in delay.
Yes.
It was completely bizarre, but I can't believe you brought that up.
Well,
I can't even imagine what the rest of this interview is going to be like.
Yeah, you just wait. Because I will tell you who else gave the invocation at their high school graduation. That was me, Suzanne.
You?
On the football field with
is
the
echo. Is that because you
with the
were
echo.
Valedictorian?
I wasn't, and I don't appreciate you bringing that up, Suzanne.
Well, tell me why. There must have been some special reason that you were chosen to give the invocation.
Because I was class secretary, and they needed to give me something to do.
So did you have that experience where there was a delay?
I did. And it, I felt like really accentuated that I wasn't invoking the name of a higher spirit because everyone was waiting for it, and it just didn't echo back. Now, something you have done that I have not done, you, my friend, were a foot model.
Yes, I was.
I don't even know what that means.
I'll tell you what that means. It means, well, you've posed for pictures before.
Sure.
Right? And so being a model in and of itself for someone like me who thinks it's absurd to just pose for pictures and get paid without actually doing anything, I want to speak, I want to perform, I want to make people laugh, I want to host something or act or do something, not just sit or stand there. It seems so ridiculous to me. And it's so objectifying and bizarre. But back when I was 25, when I was modeling, it paid $120 an hour 25 years ago. So, you know, sure, I'll do that. But you feel so, they don't care what your name is. You know, they just tape your boobs together and move you around and take pictures of you, and you go home and you feel sort of gross. Well, when you're foot modeling, that goes like exponentially to another level of objectification. So here's what happens. So you're all of the photographer and the clients and the ad agency executives are all, I'm not kidding, lying down on the floor, right, staring at your feet. and you're wearing some certain shoe, right? And it's all about the lighting. And so from the ankles up, you don't even exist. Talk about not existing.
Wow.
You don't exist. Only your feet exist. And so they're pushing your, you know, your feet and your toes in different positions and shooting pictures and having a whole conversation that, where you are not part of it at all. But the best part of all, Ken, is that every once in a while, you have to lie down on the floor and raise your legs up in the air like you're a woman trying to keep sperm inside of her to get pregnant, right? Because you have to let the blood drain out of the veins in your feet because, you know, blood in veins is, that's not attractive. You have to pretend that you don't have blood in your veins. So you let the blood drain out and then you stand up and they shoot picture until the blood starts rushing in again and then you have to lie down with your legs in the air again. So that's what it's like to be a foot model.
I feel like even someone who had a foot fetish would be a part of that experience and say, yeah, you know what, I'm out.
Exactly. And by the way, I love that you brought up foot fetishes because I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but I have male fans with foot fetishes.
Oh, gosh.
Especially when I was on Breakfast Time on FX and Fox After Breakfast on Fox, this morning show where there's something about morning television when you're on the air every morning and people have a TV in every room of their house and
right.
They're in their pajamas, like brushing their teeth while they're watching you. There's this familiarity where they think they know you and that you're their best friend, which doesn't exist with actors in movies or in primetime
right.
shows. Do you know what I mean? There's something about morning television. Anyway, I would get all this fan mail from different guys saying, you have gorgeous feet. I like your feet. You have pretty feet. Because I did one segment where I was wearing a bathing suit and I was next to a swimming pool and it was about safety if you have a dog. Something about safety for your dog in a swimming pool or something like that, right? And so instead of getting any mail about, you know,
saving
that
dogs
or anything, it was all about my feet.
Oh,
can I have a picture of your Suzanne, could you please send me a photograph of your bare feet? Let me think. No. I mean, just the image of somebody off onto a photo of my feet is so weird. Some guy said, can you send me a pair of your high-heeled shoes that you've worn? Guess what that means? He's going to sniff it like, what, Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet? I mean, it's astonishing.
Sometimes I think, well, gosh, it's the sixth year of doing this show. Clearly, we've covered all the material there is to cover. And then Suzanne comes on, and I realize, no.
No one's ever said that on the show.
Although I would like to caution our listeners, what Suzanne said about knowing these morning personalities, that is indeed true. Obviously, that does not apply, though, to me and Sam Champion. I feel he really does know me, but that's different.
He's hot, right?
Yes. Yes, and as someone who grew up in the New York City area, I grew up with Sam Champion, so very exciting, very exciting. Oh, my gosh, so much more to talk about. House Hunters, how about that gig?
Yeah, that I never would have predicted that would go on as long as it did, and it's still going.
And you dealt with some, I have to say, I want to call them characters. I know that they were real people, but there were some hilarious characters on that show, some pretty funny, by the way, gay house hunters, which you have to appreciate that it was just normalized. There was never this episode of House Hunters where, you know, the opening credits had this big rainbow, and you said, and now we have
yes.
a gay couple.
That was one of the things that I really appreciated about the show, is that we never would say, gay Ron and Tom are looking
right.
for a house, or interracial Paula and Mike are looking for a house. It was just treated as these people are looking for a house.
Yeah.
I have a couple of inside things to tell you about House Hunters.
Tell me.
One is that somebody told me that there was, in college, first of all, I can't believe the range of socioeconomic, racial, and age distribution of people that watch House Hunters.
Nice.
Right? Like, I remember going to some Hollywood party, and like, this gangster rapper comes up to me, and he goes, are you Suzanne Wong from House Hunters? And I was like, what? You watch the show? I mean, it's just crazy, right? But the college kids watched the show, and they came up with a drinking game.
Oh, no.
Which was anytime any House Hunter said the word nice during the tour, like, oh, this living room is nice, or this kitchen is nice, or the backyard is nice, everyone took a shot of tequila
wow.
or something. So there's a House Hunters drinking game for the word nice, and I'm sure that all the segment producers on House Hunters are thinking, could you get a thesaurus? Like, is there any other adjective you can think of than nice? And then another big deal was, so because I play this character, my alter ego when I do stand-up is Sung-hee Park, and she's fresh off the boat from Korea, and she's never done stand-up before. And she's unwittingly offensive and vulgar and racist, but she doesn't know it. She's naive and innocent, and she's just copied down jokes phonetically. And so it's a satire on racism and stereotypes and prejudice in America. And people either love it and think it's the funniest thing ever, or they're completely offended by it. Anyway, for me to play that character involves me wanting to have long, straight hair that I can put in a ponytail to play this character. If I have a short, you know, Americanized, sassy, modern haircut, it doesn't work to play the Sung-hee Park character.
Right.
So I always had the same, you know, my hair was long and straight all through House Hunters so that I could, anytime I wanted to, go and perform this stand-up comedy alter ego. And I don't know if you know, but for women, this can get sort of dull. It's fun to change it up. So I thought, I know, I'll grow my bangs out. So I'll have a little variety by growing my bangs out. I can't get my hair cut, you know, short or anything, but I could grow out my bangs. Now, growing out bangs takes a while, and
yeah.
There's that awkward phase where, you know, it doesn't look that great because they're not bangs, but they're not, you know, all grown out into the rest of your hair. And I'm having this awkward phase happen on the air. And I start getting all this hate mail.
Oh, no.
From viewers, because you know how crazy people can be, saying,
yeah.
You know, Suzanne Wong, what are you doing? You look terrible without bangs. You need your bangs again. And then on some HGTV message board, somebody cuts and pastes and sends me something that says, Suzanne Wong could show a movie on her forehead.
Oh, God.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Suzanne Wong, show us your feet.
Exactly. No one wants to see your forehead, but show us your feet. That'll turn us on.
By the way, I love the idea that my fellow deans of students across the country had to deal with judicial infractions by students who got intoxicated after watching House Hunters.
I know. That's crazy.
Because I would not be so jovial right now if I had had that experience as a former dean of students. If a student ever came to me and I said, you know, what happened? Was it your 21st birthday? No, we were watching House Hunters, and they said it was nice. I'm like, okay, there you go. There you go. Well, in April of 2011, you put out a national press release, and the press release was called Coming Out of the Cancer Closet, and it was about your battle with breast cancer. Before we even get into that, we must start, most importantly, with how is your health?
I am completely cancer-free.
Love it. Love it. How does it feel to say that right this second?
Oh, you know what's – here's progress. It felt completely normal. It didn't feel earth-shattering and revolutionary because that's been the case for, a year and a half or 2 years now. I've been able to say that.
Yeah. Well, you wrote in this press release, and Suzanne, this is really, it's just so remarkable. This is straight from the press release. Quote, Suzanne has learned many spiritual lessons about surrender, acceptance, asking for help, and receiving the love and support she is so accustomed to giving. What a journey this was for you, and the courage that you had to come out of that closet. I mean, obviously, we talk about coming out of the closet all the time on this show, and there's so many commonalities in what you did, in the bravery, in what you did, in what we talk about every week.
Wow, that just gave me chills. So here's what happened. I had breast cancer 3 times over the course of 6 years because, like most Asians, I'm an overachiever.
Of course
what?
You are.
Can't just do that once. I'm going to do that 3 times. Never enough of that. Yeah. And the third time it went to stage 4. And here's the thing. People, I'm writing a book. I'm in the process of writing a book about my whole journey because people want to know, how did you reverse stage 4 breast cancer? Because if you don't know, stage 4 is the worst. There's no stage 5. Stage 5 would mean you're dead. So statistically speaking, I'm supposed to be dead, but I don't believe in statistics because to me statistics are just numbers about what other people experienced in the past and
right.
have nothing necessarily to do with my present and my future.
Right.
And it was such a testament to the power of the mind and the spirit that the mind-body-spirit connection is palpable to me, and it boggles my mind when people don't believe that there's any interaction there, because how could there be a placebo effect where you give somebody a sugar pill but you tell them it's going to cure their thing and they physiologically test as being cured from that thing because they were told that something that has no value whatsoever, it did work.
Yeah.
you know. And what happened was I really, and I think this is true for all women that I've spoken to who have ever had breast cancer, which is that they had a history of saving, rescuing, fixing, and helping everyone else. All of their arrows were pointing outward. They were just about giving, expressing their love, and they were put on the planet to give. And I was to be everybody's fairy godmother and cheerleader and biggest fan and make everybody's wildest dreams come true. And that's what I was put on the planet to do. And I would do it until I would collapse and get a cold for a week. And when you have a lifelong journey like that, when you think about the fact that it's breast cancer and the breasts represent nurturing and giving, breast cancer represents you're not self-nurturing. You're not taking care of yourself. You're not allowing anyone else to take care of you.
Yeah.
And so I did a bunch of Western medicine things and Eastern and alternative and holistic things. I did illegal things. I left the country. I went $500,000 into debt. I had quite a journey with the things that I did. But I also changed my lifestyle. I changed what I eat, what I drink, what I think. I started meditating. I started drinking water. I started to exercise. I started to laugh more. I started to write and joke around about it. And that was the huge thing. Coming out of the closet about it was huge. And starting to throw my pride and ego out the window and ask for and receive help. Those were both huge. One of the reasons that I stayed in the closet as long as I did is in Asian culture, it's considered disgusting and low class to air your dirty laundry in public or admit that you have any problems or that you would need help. What are you talking about? We're perfect.
Right.
Everything fine. Don't worry. Everything perfect. You don't worry. Thank you. And it's like such crap.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And then I learned in spiritual programs that we are only as sick as our secrets, right? And so I was keeping it a secret, thinking I'll muscle through and power through this myself. Well, if the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, it was not working for me to stay in the closet, clearly.
Right.
I kept getting it over and over again. I was not getting better. And when I finally came out of the closet, it was so liberating, and the outpouring of love and support. I did a Facebook post, and it was mind-boggling what happened. People started throwing fundraisers for me, in-person fundraisers, like live events and online events, and fans that I never met in Bulgaria were sending $50 to my website to help me pay for my bills. And people, just the outpouring of love and support. And people started coming up to me and saying things like, I have AIDS, or I'm infertile, or my uncle raped me. It was like some sort of vicarious permission and of to be honest and courageous about everybody's stuff that started to happen. And so it really did blow me away. And it was unbearable at first to let people come into my house.
I bet.
And people, friends, I mean, and everyone I thought was my friend was, and who gets to find that out? It was like I was Jimmy Stewart at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. People came over and walked my dog and scrubbed my floor and brought me food and told me jokes and brought funny movies over and rubbed my feet. And I would just be like, oh, like, you know, I can't, it's unbearable. But then I started to finally get better.
Yeah. Oh. It's just a story about community. Obviously, you were at the heart of it, but what an incredible tale about community. Amazing. Well, in one of the most awkward transitions, you know who else is pretty brave?
Who?
That would be Davina from the new hit comedy, From Here, just go with it, From Here On Out.
Yeah, she's very brave. She thinks that she's a fantastic actress, but she's not. And she's a maid in a Beverly Hills mansion. And she, her bosses are out of the country for months. And she finds out that there's a show shooting in L.A. Called Guy Dubai International Gay Spy, and she wants to be on it. And she also finds out through the network of maids, because all the maids know all the gossip, that this production is in desperate need of a location to film, and they're running out of budget. So Davina crashes the audition and says that she has a place where they can shoot for free, but they have to give her a part in every episode. You know, I'm an immigrant from Korea. My name is Davina Sung-hee. You know, it's like a piece of my Sung-hee Park character that I developed. And you get to see her in every episode of Guy Dubai International Gay Spy. It takes place in a different country in the world. And so in one episode that takes place in Scotland, Davina is playing a character named Fiona, who's a Scottish barmaid, and she's doing a terrible Scottish accent mixed with a Korean accent, and she's a bad actress. So who doesn't want to watch that? It's like a train wreck in slow motion, and it's hilarious.
Well, the show has debuted at this point. I would imagine you're getting such fun feedback.
It is so much fun. So Terry Ray is the writer, creator, brainchild, star of this. It's like 30 Rock meets Three's Company,
yeah.
And it's campy and retro and fun, and there's full frontal nudity. What?
There is.
And it's on Here TV. So Here TV has a premium YouTube channel that you can subscribe to, and also Here TV is a cable subscription network, and it's called From Here On Out. I got to work with Juliette Mills from Danny and the Professor.
Yes,
what?
You did.
And TJ Hoban and Adrian Gonzalez and Michael Lanham are all so ridiculously hot. Emrys Cooper's in it. Austin Robert Miller plays the young Here TV executive. Julie Brown does some guest starring on it. And do you know Sam Pancake?
He's of course.
Awesome. Yes. So it's just been such a delight. The cast and crew and shooting it, it's been so much fun. And so there's 6 episodes available to watch.
Well, here's the deal, Suzanne. We had Terry Ray and Sam Irvin on the show a few weeks ago, and they got to play our little homegrown game show, and they won prizes. And we all agreed that you should have a chance to play our little game show as well.
Oh, okay.
I know. So we're going to ask you 6 questions, and we actually had Terry Ray supply 6 answers for you. And if you match up with his answers, if you get 3 out of the 6, we're going to send you some This Show Is So Gay swag as well.
Oh, boy. I'm Asian. You don't understand. I didn't get to study.
And yet you have a background in improv theater. So look to your feet whenever you need inspiration.
But this is like Match Game then.
I know. That was my show. I wanted to sit between Brett Summers and Charles Nelson Reilly so badly.
Oh, and you know that Terry Ray studied with Charles Nelson
Reilly. Oh, trust me.
So
yes.
So jealous of that,
I
right?
was such a fangirl. All right. Are you ready to play? Because we want you to win.
I'm ready.
Some of these are hard. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
So these are all answers that Terry Ray supplied for you. Question number 1, what other role would you, Suzanne, take on From Here On Out other than the actor role? What role would you like to take on?
Other than the actor role?
Yes. On the crew, what role would you like to take on?
And this is what Terry thinks that I'm going to say?
Yes.
Director?
That is the correct answer. Very good. I'm not worried about you. Question number 2. With which character did Terry say that you would like to be stranded on a desert island with?
Wow. Okay. I'm going to say Rico.
I'm sorry. The correct answer was Jimmy. Terry Ray said so that you could get him to write her leading roles all day.
Oh, that makes sense.
All right.
Okay.
All right, we got 1 correct answer. We got 4 more to go. What is the craziest thing that Terry Ray has written for you to do on the show? I'm going to even give you a hint on this one. You've already talked about it.
It's to play a Scottish barmaid named Fiona.
That is the correct answer. Yeah. He said the chase scene with a rocket launcher attack is
oh
a
my
bad
God.
Actress. Yes.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen that one yet.
Oh, my God. Ken, you're going to plot. It is so funny.
I love it. All right, 2 correct answers. Only 1 more to go, and you got 3 more chances.
Okay.
Question number 4. What did Terry Ray say would be your Suzanne's first purchase after winning the $100 million jackpot?
You mean if I won the lottery?
Exactly.
That's hard.
Some of these are hard.
I don't even know what my answer is. Now I'm trying to figure out what Terry's answer for me would be. What would I buy with $100 million?
Maybe go with your own answer and hope that he knows you well.
You know what I love about thinking of this?
Yes.
I'm looking around my life going, I have everything.
Oh.
I have everything I need to make me happy. Like, I'm just so grateful.
That is not the correct answer.
No, I know. That's not my answer. My answer is...
Internal bliss is not the correct answer.
What would I buy? What would I buy? An animal shelter.
Huh. That's kind of close. I'm giving you a half point on that one. Terry Ray said an artist's retreat.
Whoa,
an artist's
so
retreat.
Cool.
That's pretty close. I'm giving
you
half point. All right, 2 more to go. What did Terry Ray say would be Davina's first purchase after winning the lottery?
A mink coat?
I'm sorry, the correct answer is Meryl Streep's house.
That's a way better answer.
And finally, and we'll ballpark this one, so you can dance around this one, and I feel still get it right because no one loses at this game show.
Okay.
We're going to do a little word association with you. Okay, here we go. I say Juliet Mills. You say?
Nanny and the Professor.
We'll try again. I say Juliet Mills, and let's go with more of an adjective.
Oh.
Yes.
And I say?
Terry said she might get it right. She talks that way. I'm not sure what this says about you.
What? That means it's vulgar.
It's not at all vulgar.
Exquisite. I think she's exquisite.
I feel that's close enough, so I'm giving it to you. He
what
said.
Is it?
He said blistastic.
Oh, yes. That's how I talk. She is. She's blistastic. I also say when I'm really so happy that I might fall over, I call it bliscombobulated.
Nice. Nice. And thus, with our rules, you have won some swag from our show.
Here's what concerns me. Terry Ray is a better Suzanne Huang than Suzanne Huang. That's a little disconcerting.
That's why they invented therapy, Suzanne. That's what it's for, that to work these things through. What do you have coming up that we should all know about?
Well, I'm doing something that I'm really nervous about in a good way.
Okay.
I am hosting my first sketch comedy live show at Second City on Sunday, April 6th.
So exciting.
It's called TMI Live, and it's at Second City at 7:30. And I'm posting about it on Facebook and Twitter. But basically all week we're pitching and writing and rehearsing like they would on Saturday Night Live. And then we're doing the live show on stage on Sunday night. So I'm excited about that. I also, a while back, I was invited with my best friend Vanessa Marcel to be sitting eating the food at Hell's Kitchen, and I think that's airing on Thursday night. So you might see, I don't know if you ever watch Hell's Kitchen, but I will be sitting there eating the food that they're making on Hell's Kitchen.
Was
and
it good?
Did, yes, it was divine.
Great.
And I just did a sitcom pilot that Russell Simmons is producing called Hungry, where I'm playing a crazy minister named Reverend Suki.
I love Yay! That. And where should folks go to keep track of all the amazing things you're doing?
You can find me on Facebook at Suzanne Huang, W-H-A-N-G. Thank you for pronouncing my last name and first name correctly. I'm on Twitter at Suzanne Huang, and my website is suzannehuang.com.
There's no way I'm going to mispronounce it when I watched a clip of you and Suzanne Summers bonding over your first name.
Exactly, because I can say, hi, I'm Suzanne, and 1 second later they'll say, hi, Susan. And I'm thinking, no one said that. That's spelled and pronounced differently. You know, it's amazing. It's like if you say I'm Ken and I say hi, you know, Ben. What? No one said Ben. What's happening?
I just envision all these emails saying, Susan Wang, show us your feet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Suzanne Huang, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Everybody needs to stroll on over to your sites and, of course, go to HereTV.com and check out From Here On Out. I watched the first couple episodes. It's hilarious. You are hilarious. Your journey and your bravery and the way that you use your voice in all your projects is just so unbelievably inspiring, and we just look forward to so many great things from you.
Thank you, Ken. And also, if you don't know, I have a great story about I just married a man I was friends with for 20 years and secretly in love with the whole time, and it turns out he was secretly in love with me, too, and we just got married.
I love that. Well, look, that if that's not a story to end with, and he's cool with your feet.
Yes, he loves my feet.
Awesome, awesome. Suzanne, what an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Ken. Have a blistastic day.
Brings us to the end of another episode of This Show Is So Gay. Get out there, folks. Go do whatever it is that you do best to raise up the voices of your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you're out there making a difference in the world, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?